Let's look at the outline. Defense policy in the United States. The first section there was a review from 2 weeks ago when I talked about this. Governments are responsible to defend their nations from attacks. Peter says that governments are to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. Paul says that government is to bear the sword, Romans 13:4, so it can be a terror to bad conduct. It's to carry out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. And so this is a good thing for governments to use superior force against evil, because in doing so, Paul calls them God's servant for your good. I'll skip down a couple of points there to the next major square bullet point. If the U.S. has a moral obligation to defend against an aggressor or aggressors, then it should have enough military power to be able to defeat any other nation or combination of nations that has the potential to attack it. That is, our government should say, we have a responsibility, I think a moral responsibility, to protect our citizens, to protect our nation. Well, if so, then we should look around and say, who might attack us? Do we have enough military power to defeat a potential attack? That's the summary of my overview of what a nation's responsibility is. Now, the problem is that a pacifist objection will come up. And at the heart of political liberalism on defense is pacifism. That the use of superior military force is always evil. We should avoid it. Try to negotiate and talk with people, and maybe everybody will get along. And the pacifist objection to a strong military power in the country is having so much military power is dangerous. And it's the weapons that are the real problem. It's a military weaponry that increases tension and instability, making war more likely. If you're watching movies, you're reading newspaper articles, a lot of times people say, well, all this increased weaponry is just increasing the chance of war and conflict. But when you listen to those sentences, just ask yourself, are they saying the real problem is military weaponry in the world? Or are they recognizing that the real problem is some people have very evil hearts, and they get power, and they try to conquer other nations? And so my response is that the idea that military weapons in themselves cause wars, that comes from an assumption that the ultimate cause of evil is not the hearts of human beings, but some influence like weapons, some influence outside of human beings. Human beings are good. Don't blame human beings for war. My goodness, it must be the fault of the weapons. But to the contrary, I think a biblical position would say there's good and evil in every human heart, and people are responsible to choose between good and evil, and there are some rulers in the world in previous years and today who are so evil and have power that if they can, they'll try to conquer other countries and impose their will on them. So the tendency toward evil, on your outline here, I'm saying, the tendency toward evil in some people is beyond reason, negotiation, or compromise, or United Nations resolutions. They just ignore them. And that power of evil in some people can only be restrained by superior power, military power. So God gives civil governments the power of the sword, Romans 13:4, to restrain such unreasoning commitments to evil. My conclusion, military weapons for just governments, for good governments, are God-ordained and not themselves the cause of evil. So let's look back at especially the last half of the 20th century. Was there any need for military weaponry? Yes. We had Hitler trying to conquer the world, overrunning much of Europe. We had Stalin ruling over the Soviet Union and conquering much of Eastern Europe and murdering literally millions of people. We had Japan conquering much of China, coming into the capital city at that time of China, of Nanking, and murdering 300,000 out of 600,000 people in the city, both civilians and soldiers. And those are just three examples, and there are others. That was in the past. Now, what about today? Current threats of possible attack against the United States or against its allies. And I just want to walk through these and say, why do we need a strong defense? Well, First, North Korea, 24 million people. I am sorry. This was on my... When I did these PowerPoint presentations, these were wonderful maps of the world. And for some reason on this screen, it isn't showing up, right? All you can see... Okay, well... That's North Korea, 24 million people. Now, it's not large. Arizona has 7.6 million people. So it's about three times as many people as Arizona. But it has the highest per capita involvement in military forces of any country in the world. And it's perhaps the poorest country in the world in terms of just people dying of starvation, but has this very evil military dictator. And if he could, he would invade South Korea and take it over. That war in the 1950s, I think, was never officially concluded. They think they're still at war. There was a ceasefire or an armistice. And this top border of North Korea is a long border with China. And China is huge and is the major trading partner of North Korea. Then there is Iran. Oh, my goodness. Iran has 75 million people. So it's quite large. It's about twice as large as Iraq, which is next door here. Iraq has something like 30 million people. So Iran, ancient Persia, Persian Empire with Esther and Mordecai and Nebuchadnezzar. Not Nebuchadnezzar, that's Babylon. Esther and Mordecai and Nehemiah, that's Persia. And it borders Iraq, the Persian Gulf. It borders Turkey. It borders Afghanistan. It borders Pakistan. And it borders some of the former Soviet republics. So this is really a strategic location in the whole world, in Iran. Now, what about these countries? I don't think they're going to launch an attack against the United States, Korea, or Iran right now. But Korea apparently has nuclear weapons. Iran is working hard to acquire them, and perhaps will have them soon, if it doesn't already. And so the threat of a missile attack against U.S. military bases somewhere near these countries, or U.S. territories, or U.S. allies, because... From Iran, it's not too far to Israel. And from South Korea, it's just across that demilitarized zone. From North Korea to South Korea, a possibility of attack against U.S. allies is very real. And these countries could launch terrorist plots, even in the United States, if they wanted to destabilize our country. All right, so those are two very real threats, very evil regimes. They are just not going to be deterred by negotiation. Why do I say that? Because they haven't. Over UN resolution after UN resolution, they just ignore and they keep building armaments and trying to expand. And then, what about Russia? Geographically, the largest country in the world, 142 million people. From 1945 to 91, during the Cold War, they were our primary potential enemy in a war. The current government, there was some signs of hope after the Soviet Union fell and some Eastern European countries obtained a form of independence, but it still is today essentially a dictatorship ruled by a small group of Communist Party officials under Vladimir Putin. Occasionally, Russia acts as an ally, but they're very unreliable and unpredictable. Its capacity for aggression against the United States and other nations is very real. It has a strong military and an extensive nuclear arsenal with intercontinental reach. And, you know, I looked up yesterday, how many nations had aircraft carriers. Aircraft carrier is the most powerful fighting base of anything in the world. You take an aircraft carrier with jet planes, and wherever you move it in the world, you control the whole military situation for about 1,000 miles around the aircraft carrier. So you kind of move your aircraft carrier wherever you want to project influence. The United States has 11 active aircraft carriers. The rest of the world has 11 aircraft carriers. I think England has two, and France has one or two, and I think Italy has one, and Turkey has one, and Russia didn't have any. And I thought, or maybe has one. Why doesn't Russia have any aircraft carriers? Well, Russia is an aircraft carrier. That is, if you want to get to Alaska from Russia, you just have to fly 10 miles from some one island that Russia owns. And if you want to get to China, well, they border on China. You want to get to India, they border, they're just to the north of India. You want to get to Europe, they're all over here, right into Europe. You want to get North America, they're not far away. That is, Russia, by a polar route, is kind of straddling the top of the world, and it straddles 11 or 13 time zones. So it's still possibly a very real threat. And, of course, it has all those nuclear weapons. Other problems. Venezuela. Well, this is South America, if you could kind of imagine that. And Venezuela is at the top of South America. Cuba is just up here, and then Florida is just up here. So Venezuela is a problem because Hugo Chavez has become a dictator, and he is exporting instability and basically totalitarian government to other countries in Latin America. And then there's Cuba with 11 million people. Oh, here we're getting a better map. And so both Venezuela and Cuba are military dictatorships. They destabilize countries that are relatively close to the U.S. border. Chavez in Venezuela has placed troops on the border of Colombia, and that's misspelled on your outline. The country of Colombia is Colombia, not Colombia with a U. That's the city in South Carolina. Colombia. He's placed troops on the border of Colombia. Colombia has cleaned out its drug cartel, and it's a very peaceful, democratic society now. It's our friend. But Colombia is right next door to Venezuela. And then Chavez has persuaded Bolivia, which is the other side of Colombia, to put troops on Colombia's border, too. So they're kind of threatened from both sides. Cuba has a long history of supporting anti-democratic thugs within Nicaragua. Where's Nicaragua? It's here. The Dominican Republic, that's here. El Salvador is over here, where there's a cutout in the square. And Bolivia, which is down in the middle of South America. And so Chavez and Castro in Cuba have just been trying to send soldiers and money and all sorts of destabilizing influence everywhere they can in Central and South America. That's really a problem for us. And it could get worse because these are our closest neighbors. The more such Castro-Chavez influence grows and overthrows governments in South America, the more the U.S. will have to deal with hostile neighboring countries on its doorstep. And then the big problem, China. 1.3 billion people, the most populated country in the world. We have relatively good relations between China and the United States, but the government of China is totalitarian and autocratic. It's ruled by only 9 people, the Politburo Standing Committee, and that means the future direction of China is unpredictable. Some troublesome signs are these. China has been establishing bases of influence in Latin America and Africa. And these are possible centers to project military power. You know, the Panama Canal is now run by a Chinese company under the probable control of the government of China. That's a strategic place for us. I just heard recently that you can drive now the whole length of Africa on a road that says, built by the People's Republic of China. Late Congressman Henry Hyde from Illinois said the United States' influence on the Asian mainland is dangerously close to being removed entirely. Peter Brooks of the Heritage Foundation said China is legitimizing and encouraging Africa's most repressive regimes, increasing the likelihood of weak and failed states. If you look around the world, wherever you get brutal, repressive regimes, somehow behind the scenes, you've got China supplying it, upholding it, the evil government and the totalitarian government. I'm not sure why they're doing that. Large navy, 255,000 sailors, 58 submarines. Where are they? 58 submarines. We don't know. Well, maybe we do know, but I'm not sure if we know. It's hard to find out. 2.3 million personnel in their armed forces, and a space system that demonstrated its ability in January 2007 to shoot U.S. communication satellites out of the sky. You think your cell phone is working? Well, it might not. Now, they didn't shoot a U.S. satellite out of the sky. I think they shot one of their own satellites out of the sky, but they were basically saying, watch this. Pow, satellite's gone. If we can do it once, we can do it again. Then Chinese hackers, very skilled computer hackers, they periodically launch attacks against the highest levels of U.S. military information networks. A 2008 report to Congress stated China is even now planting viruses in U.S. computer systems that they will activate in the event of a military conflict with the United States. And I just saw December 6th, just 6 days ago, in the Wall Street Journal, an article by Mortimer Zuckerman, the chairman and editor-in-chief of U.S. News and World Report. And he's reporting on a recent book called Cyber War by Richard Clark, former White House counterterrorism czar or director. Richard Clark, in this book, Cyber War, says hackers can tap into computer networks and move money, spill oil, vent gas, blow up generators, derail trains, crash airplanes, cause missiles to detonate, wipe out realms of financial and supply chain data. Havoc can be created at the blink of an eye from remote locations overseas. Mr. Clark, in this book, no, he's a former White House director of counterterrorism. He says China is one of the key players in developing cyber war capability. Clark believes that the secrets behind everything from pharmaceutical formulas to bioengineering designs and nanotechnologies to weapon systems and everyday industrial products have been stolen by the Chinese army or private hackers who turn them over to China. Not many people realize that all of our nation's air, land, and sea forces rely on network technologies that are vulnerable to cyber weapons. If these computer networks are compromised or obliterated, the U.S. military would be incapable of operating. So that's a concern. We're talking about God's sovereignty in a few minutes. Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, said the Chinese are developing more capable long-range conventional strike systems and short- and medium-range ballistic missiles with terminally guided maneuverable warheads able to attack U.S. carriers and air bases. Well, we may have 11 aircraft carriers, but if missiles hit those aircraft carriers, they're not much good anymore. So China is extremely powerful, and if it should decide to become an aggressor, we would certainly need to be well prepared. next page. P.S. I forgot to mention one other thing. Islamic terrorist threats from various Muslim countries, and that's the most prominent military challenge today. So that's a lot of areas to be concerned about in the world. And right now, these countries are still maybe preparing for some kind of attack, but they haven't launched any attack. Then there's another factor. That is that the United States has defense alliances, and we've agreed to help protect other countries, smaller countries. We do have the most powerful military force in the world, 1.4 million people on active duty, and almost another million, 848,000 in reserve. Our defense budget of $500 billion is the largest in the world. But what was the stimulus package? $814 billion, larger than our defense budget. There's Navy personnel, there's Air Force personnel, and I looked at this last night and I thought, oh my goodness, how did we leave out Army? If Bob Kane is here, I'm going to be really in trouble. The Navy has 329,000 personnel, Air Force 327,000, and the Army 550,000. So 1.4 million in our military, 5,000 aircraft. I mean, there's great military power, greater than any nation. And as I mentioned, 11 aircraft carriers, larger and bigger than any other country's aircraft carriers. And no other country has more than two, and most of those are friendly countries to us. But China is building aircraft carriers. That great military power, I think, implies that we have great responsibility to assist the world in maintaining peace. And the United States has recognized this for a long time. Even in our early history as a nation, almost 200 years ago, President James Monroe, our fifth president, I think he was our fifth president, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, I think, he announced a Monroe Doctrine. He said, if any European nation attacks or attempts to colonize any nation in North or South America, the United States will intervene to oppose such action. This Monroe Doctrine has been used, invoked on numerous occasions by U.S. presidents, and there's some debate today over how strongly we will enforce it, but it still exists as a strong statement of U.S. policy. And then we got together after World War II with a number of nations in Europe and formed the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Canada also joined that. And it was first signed in 1949 and includes 28 countries now. And it says if England is attacked or if Norway is attacked, well, we'll consider it an attack against us and we'll come to help defend each other. And if we're attacked, they're supposed to come and help defend us. And then there are mutual defense treaties that we have with other countries, like Israel and Taiwan. Now, I want to give you, there is Israel. And now these lines do show up a little bit better here. Surrounding Israel, we have Lebanon, basically controlled by Syria to the north. There's Syria. Here's Jordan, Iraq, Iran, and then over here, Saudi Arabia, and over here, Egypt. So you look around, these are Arab countries surrounding Israel, and Israel's quite small, 7.6 million people. Oh, did I say Arizona had 7 million people before? Arizona has 6.6 million people. So Israel has about, just, you know, we have 6.5 million people in Arizona, Israel has 7.5 million people. It's tiny compared to the Arab nations surrounding it. But we have an agreement to help defend Israel if attacked, because look at all the nations surrounding it that are hostile to it. And then Taiwan. Now you can see this map works. This is Taiwan, or the Republic of China, officially called. And this is mainland China, or the People's Republic of China. Taiwan has 23 million people versus 1.3 billion in China. That is, this country, China, has 50 times as many people as this little country, Taiwan. And this big country wants this little country. They think they're a breakaway rebellious province, and they want them back. We have agreed to help defend that island nation. And they've been friends with us, and they are economically advanced, democratic society. But could we do that? Could we fulfill our obligation to help defend them? I don't know. And we have an agreement to help defend South Korea. Well, I had North Korea on the map before, and here's South Korea right next to it. Should we have treaties like this? why doesn't South Korea have nuclear weapons? Well, because they think we'll help them. We have 28,000 troops still stationed in South Korea since 1950s. So since around 1950, what is that, 60 years we've had troops in South Korea. We have troops in Europe. They think we'll help defend them if Russia should ever become aggressive again. Why? Now, Israel has nuclear weapons. They haven't confirmed it, but we believe they do. But Israel also depends on us. Now, is that right to have these alliances? They are voluntary and, I think, mutually beneficial. The United States decided a long time ago that agreements to defend other nations that want to help us and be our friends, that these agreements are in the best interest of the nation, and they contribute to the protection of world peace. They provide deterrence against aggressors. Nations with whom we have such agreements are of great value to the United States. You think of the trade that we carry out with Israel, Taiwan, South Korea, for instance, or Latin American countries, with the Monroe Doctrine saying if somebody attacks you, we'll take it as an attack on us. So it means that we're sort of committed to protect smaller countries in various parts of the world. Is that good? Well, there are many benefits to us and to the world that come from that, is what I'm saying. And if they're voluntary agreements and they help both countries, then I think they're good. In addition, we have a fundamental document that our country was founded on called the Declaration of Independence. It established the existence of the United States as a nation. And in the Declaration of Independence, we said, we believe certain things. One thing we agreed and declared was that there are certain truths, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, including life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Now, do people in South Korea now have protection of life and liberty and pursuit of happiness? Yes. In Israel? Yes. But do people in North Korea have those protections? No. If North Korea overruns South Korea, pow. They've lost a lot of their lives, and they've lost their liberty and their pursuit of ability to pursue happiness as they wish. So this implies that it's in our best interest, but it's consistent with our fundamental, our foundational convictions as a nation to protect, to promote the protection of life and human freedoms in various nations around the world. In other words, I'm saying it's a good thing that Taiwan is free from communist Chinese domination. It's a good thing that South Korea is free from being overrun by North Korea. It's a good thing for the world, and it's consistent with what we say we believe as a nation in the Declaration of Independence. All men, not just Americans, South Koreans too, are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Now, I'm saying that in contrast to a view held by Congressman Ron Paul. Ron Paul, in his book Revolution, argues for what he calls a non-interventionist view. He says, we don't have any business getting involved in the problems of other countries. Congressman Ron Paul from Texas is conservative in many ways, and I agree with many things that he says on other topics. But I, not all. But I think he's dead wrong on foreign policy. Here's what he says. He says, foreign interventionism is of no benefit to American citizens, but instead is a threat to our liberties. He opposes all foreign aid, no foreign aid even to Israel. He opposes foreign military bases. He doesn't think we should have troops in Korea and Japan and Europe as we do. As far as the attacks on 9/11 against the United States, the destruction of the World Trade Center and the attack on the Pentagon, he said, it's our fault. That's Ron Paul. And you've seen him when he was in the presidential debates, presidential primary debates for the Republican Party. He held to this line. And what does he say? They attack us because we've been over there. We've been bombing Iraq for 10 years. So it's really our fault that we were attacked on 9/11. I just find that very, very wrong. Now, here are my three reasons that I disagree with Ron Paul on his view of foreign policy. First of all, you can't find non-interventionism, or other people would call that a variety of isolationism. You cannot find that in the U.S. Constitution. Ron Paul uses quotes from George Washington and other of the founding fathers saying, oh, we shouldn't get involved in these affairs of other nations. But I think it's really important that he can't get quotes from the Constitution to show that. I think what George Washington was saying was, we're a young nation, we barely got our existence from England, and now to get involved in other nations is too much for us. We're too young, we're too weak, let's straighten out our own house first. But George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, others, they were wise enough not to set that isolationist view in concrete by putting it in the Constitution. They kept it out. And the reason they kept it out, I think, is because they thought maybe the United States is going to grow really, really big and really powerful, and maybe we have a different view of getting involved in other countries of the world and helping them to promote freedom and democracy and promote trade and cultural exchange and other things with us. So let's not say anything about non-interventionism or isolationism in the Constitution. Ron Paul can't find it there. And then the Bible doesn't support non-interventionism. In fact, I notice one verse in this little prophet, Obadiah, in the Old Testament. Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. Obadiah. And God, through Obadiah, prophesies against Edom, neighboring country, non-Israelites, and says this, Obadiah 11. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth, that is Jerusalem. Strangers carried off his wealth. That was Babylonians coming to attack Jerusalem. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off Jerusalem and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. That is by being a neighbor who stood by and could help, and you just watched. You stood aloof. You did nothing. You were like the Babylonian attackers. I think God is condemning the non-interventionism of Edom. And number C, another reason I disagree with Ron Paul, is that the great power of the United States gives us an obligation to help weak nations who are attacked when we are able to, or when we have such treaties with such nations. Such support has stopped aggression in the world. NATO halted the USSR from expanding into Western Europe, taking over Germany and France once again after World War II and other countries in Europe, Norway, Sweden, Finland. The Taiwan Agreement deters China from just marching in and taking over. The South Korea alliance deters North Korea from capturing South Korea. Support of Israel stabilizes Palestine. Support of Kuwait stopped Saddam Hussein and possibly saved Saudi Arabia from Saddam Hussein's invasion as well. The actions of the U.S. military the world over deter hostility, and they make the world a freer place. So Ron Paul's non-interventionist policies, which would halt such actions, would bring about a much less free, much less peaceful, and much more antagonistic and dangerous world. The world would be taken over by more and more people with the mentality of Adolf Hitler or Stalin. And some of the current candidates for actions like that are Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Castro in Cuba, and his successor, and I've forgotten the name of the dictator in North Korea. So I'm going to read a paragraph from my book on Ron Paul. In conclusion, does Ron Paul really think that the world would be better off with the horrible communist government of North Korea controlling South Korea, with communist China controlling Taiwan, with Saddam Hussein controlling Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and exploiting terrorism around the world? Does Ron Paul really think that the world would be better off if the Soviets under Stalin had been allowed to overrun Western Europe, including Germany and France and other countries after World War II? Does he think the world would be a better place if the U.S. Navy did not protect the international shipping lanes of all the oceans of the world? I'm convinced that these actions by the United States have made the world a much better and more peaceful place. For all of these reasons, I cannot believe that Ron Paul's non-interventionist policies would do anything but bring about a much less free, much less peaceful, and much more antagonistic and dangerous world. That's page 399. Point D here, I say there's a value to the world of a strong U.S. military. It doesn't bother me that we have the strongest military in the world. You go to Europe, many Europeans just resent the immense military power of the United States. And they think, well, that's just making other countries feel threatened and it's destabilizing the world. My response is no. Superior military weaponry in the hands of a nation that protects freedom for itself and other countries is a good thing for the world, not a harmful thing. Superior military power in the hands of a peace-loving, freedom-supporting nation brings great benefits to the world. Benefits, number one. Genuine peace in the world comes from the military might of the U.S. and other peace-loving military powers. And those nations who are allied with us promote and sustain and support peace in regional areas around the world. U.S. military weakness would invite war and provoke attempts at conquest by aggressive nations led by evil rulers. If all of a sudden the United States military drew back and didn't have any presence in the world, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, one after another, nations around the world neighboring to these aggressive countries would be taken over because there'd be no threat of U.S. response. However, practically, the only area of government spending that was cut in 2009 by President Obama was defense spending. And the Wall Street Journal had detailed that. You get these projections of huge increases in domestic transfer payments and entitlements and things, but the defense budget as a percentage of total gross domestic product declining. One example of budget cuts under President Obama that really trouble me is the F-22 Raptor fighter jet. And actually, when I went over, I was over at Master's Seminary teaching a class a few years ago in California, and I got taken out to lunch by some people that were there at Master's Seminary. And one of the guys was an engineer working on the F-22, and he told me a little bit about it. It was fascinating. But in 2009, in the midst of massive increases in federal government spending, more than any administration in American history, President Obama insisted on cutting funds for the F-22. What's so big about the F-22? What's a big deal? It's the most advanced fighting plane in the world. You know, you see these pictures in war movies about dogfights, one plane against another, and who's going to win. The F-22 can have four or five planes coming at it all at once from different directions and shoot them all out of the sky and just fly away unscathed. It's unbelievable. It's just an incredible airplane. It can see an approaching enemy over the horizon and destroy it before the enemy is able to see the F-22 approaching. It can look over the curve of the earth somehow by electronic navigation. And it sees planes coming at it. Pow! It destroys the oncoming plane, and the plane says, where'd that come from? It can outrun, outclimb, outmaneuver any potential enemy fighter in the world. But President Obama insisted that it be cut, that further production be cut. The U.S. Senate voted to stop production at 187 that are now produced. 250 to 380 were planned for and were thought to be needed. But President Obama would not sign the defense authorization bill until it cut funding for the F-22 fighter jet. And so Congress agreed with him. October 28, 2009, the president rejected the notion that we have to waste billions of taxpayer dollars to keep this nation secure. I think this was a tragic mistake. I have verses on God's sovereignty. I think I'm going to read those after we do some question and answer time. E.G., we got a microphone coming here.
Would appreciate your comments. You mentioned Colombia.
Yep.
And how they've managed to clean up their mess, as
yep.
I understand.
Yeah.
What's going to happen with Mexico? Why can't they seem to get their problems cleaned up? And if they don't, I would think that could become a major threat
yeah.
to us.
Yeah. I didn't list them as a threat because Mexico is an ally and a friend. Anti-government drug forces within the country are a definite, definite concern. And they're a concern here to Arizona because we're close. Yeah, I don't know the answer, E.G. I don't know. I think we can...
Should be able to get things under control?
I'm still hopeful that the government will get things under control. My hunch, my expectation is the violence is so widespread and so persistent and so evil that the population just says, do anything to wipe it out and send in the army to whole areas. And, of course, there'll be indiscriminate loss of life in those cases. But I don't think societies will tolerate the spread of anarchy forever. So, yeah, John. Or somebody else have a microphone over here? Okay.
I talked to you earlier about this, but...
you told me your name.
Lisa,
I was going to say.
What is your opinion of the U.S. government selling all the sophisticated weaponry to Middle Eastern countries, Saudi Arabia, all those countries that surround Israel that are allegedly, supposedly our, quote, allies today, but could be our enemies tomorrow?
Okay. Can I say who you work for? He works for Boeing, a defense contractor, large defense contractor. In fact, Boeing's the single largest dollar exporter of any country in the United States. And some of that's commercial, but some of it's military aircraft. I think that part of defense alliances with South Korea, Israel, our friends, Taiwan, means that we should sell weapons to them so they can defend themselves or help defend themselves. Now you mentioned Saudi Arabia. They're smiling at us now. And they're our friends, but you're saying, who knows? And, man, in general, I think the principle should be help our friends to arm themselves and protect themselves. Don't help our enemies. What about in the middle? What about if you're unsure? It's Lori. Lisa. I don't know what to say about the specifics, Lisa. I don't know. So this is my second question in a row. Mexico, I don't know what to do. And here, I don't know what to do about Middle Eastern countries that say they're our friends but could turn hostile to Israel. I suppose our governments have to make and our Congress, our elected representatives, and our president and State Department have to make those decisions on a case-by-case basis. And sometimes they go bad, but sometimes they work out very, very well and bring stability to a region, and that's good. So I like what you're doing. I like where you're working. Okay, sorry I can't do more. John?
Yeah, on Mexico, I was reading that Mexico has just about the youngest workforce, very excited, very good bunch, a 15% increase in the Mexican stock market over the last year.
Wow.
They're kind of quietly and just moving up.
Yeah, and I think they have a very good president.
They have a good president.
Yeah, Fox.
The rate of increase in violence is going down.
Oh.
The rate is going down. The line is,
leveling off.
It's leveling off.
Yep.
And it seems that because one of the questions was, should the United States be involved covertly in fighting the cartels?
Yeah.
And the answer was no, because they're not increasing exponentially like they were. It is leveling off.
Okay.
We still hear about it because we're right next door.
Right. We're an ally. Yeah. I think it's right for us to help how we can legitimately help. But what that involves, I'm not sure. Felix?
Yeah, Wayne, I've got two things I'd like you to comment on. The first one is spreading the responsibility for the citizens. We are doing a lot of things, and we have a lot of capacity, but we've overused our reserve capacity, and that there's a responsibility there towards those people. And how should we spread that responsibility for that need out through the electorate?
Do you mean the need to get more people in the armed forces?
Yeah, is a voluntary thing working right when we're overusing our reserve forces, which are citizen soldiers are working.
Yeah, yeah.
That one, and the other one
I'm concerned when I see reports in the paper that say, well, we'd like to send more troops to Afghanistan, but we don't have enough. And, wait, we're not supposed to, that's Afghanistan. That's not China or Russia. That's not a huge country of the world. That's a little country of the world. Something's wrong here.
Well, then we need a draft, I guess. That's our responsibility.
You know, Israel has a compulsory military service. South Korea has a compulsory military service. I'm sure Taiwan, I didn't read about it, but I imagine Taiwan does. Many countries do. I think there's something very healthy about having to serve in the military. And the voluntary military right now is working. We've got the best military in the world, but you and I are both concerned, is it strong enough?
Well, the other question along a similar line is that we've been at the leading edge of technology and all our weaponry and,
yep.
and so on. And the pipeline and the scientific side in that
yep.
arena, I'm getting input from people that really know that are thinking
yep.
about this is woefully short.
Yep.
We're really in bad shape
yep.
there. And can we keep that up?
Yep. I'm concerned too. You all saw the reports in the paper. We are ranked in the middle of the pack in terms of educational achievement of high school students, even in science and math, even of our best students. What I've read in the past is we lag in the first 12 years, but then in the university years, the United States universities far exceed university students all over the rest of the world. Is that right, Mike?
For a while.
For what? You've been involved at ASU for some time.
Absolutely. Currently, the American universities, I think something like 48 of the top 50 universities
yep.
in the world are in the U.S. But again, because we've closed our borders significantly over the last 10 years to a lot of foreign students,
yep.
we now a lot of other foreign countries are investing significantly in their own university infrastructure. Saudi Arabia, most of the Arab countries, India. And certainly China.
Yep.
Now some of the top and growing universities in the world are outside the United States.
Yeah, okay. So we let in hundreds of thousands of uneducated people with very little work skill and keep out the highest, most educated, highest work skill people by excessively restrictive visa requirements. Oh, yes. Problem. Well, do we have any more problems? Yes. Okay. Who is that, Vic?
Yeah. Some observations and questions. First off, I think we have to have a strong defense. I think that's one of the major purposes of government. The thing that bothers me, to what point to invest in protecting our allies that it's detrimental to our economics of this country? And I see that economically, I think we all agree with this, we're in a difficult period now, but I see a continued downward trend that could continue for the next decade and possibly longer.
Economically.
And then you look at what's going on in China, on the other hand, it continues to progress, it continues to grow, and I think that's just the sovereignty of God. There are things going on that's beyond our control. Some of the things that bothers me, 15 years ago, over 5 years, I had a lot of international responsibility, so I spent a lot of time in the Pacific Rim countries. And
in what countries?
China, Singapore, Hong Kong,
yep.
Taiwan.
Yep.
And what was interesting is that as citizens, most of us are very naive as what's going on. We were establishing strategic alliances at the time, and you're sitting there with dinner with a number of Chinese people, some act like they can't speak English when they can. And but at the end of the night, we're Kong Pao toasting each other. And this one gentleman I thought was maybe from one of the old Chinese dynasties, families that had been yeah. involved in business. And one of our Thunderbird grads kept on kicking me under the table because I said, well, does your family like own this business? By the end of the night, after about 2:30 in the morning, I find out he reports to a red Chinese general of the army.
Oh.
And a number of these plants, which we had visited, a number of them, were actually ran by the Red Chinese Army.
Yeah.
It's pretty scary. The other thing about it is that I don't think there's anything that we can do to change this, but I look at the amount of wealth that's being transferred from the United States to the Chinese. It's continuing. I don't think there's any way to stop it. That bothers me. The other thing that bothers me is that when we look at Taiwan, Hong Kong and Taiwan, great business people.
Yep.
Just phenomenal business people. Hong Kong is already part of China.
Yep.
They've kept their hands off them. But Taiwan, even when I came out here 10 years ago, I was setting up strategic alliance up in Taiwan, and I'm sitting there, and one of the companies that I'm talking to at the time, he's building a huge plant over in China. And so I'm sort of sitting there, wait a minute. His family left during the Cultural Revolution.
Yep.
They're successful business people, but they're hiring all these people and they're sending all their money to make product there to send over to us.
Yeah, I understand.
So.
Oh, world, just a lot of things going on in the world. Who's next to you here? Yes? What's your name?
My name's Tom Compton.
Tom?
I'm glad you brought up the Declaration of Independence. I think our founding fathers recognized by enumerating the right to life as one of the most important rights. We've seen an erosion of our Constitution. We see, for example, the Supreme Court making laws. And I think about the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. Almost 50 million children have been killed because of abortion. Now, it seems to me, if we're going to be consistent in helping the world, shouldn't we, as a government or as a people, demand protection of the most innocent of our life, of our individuals in our society? Or should we just change our Constitution because we seem to be ignoring it?
Yeah.
And plus, now, another one caveat here. Article 1, Section 8 gives the Congress the power to declare war. We're seeing now that the President is declaring the wars directly. So should we get rid of our Constitution and become a true democracy?
Okay, so I'm gonna come circle back from that comment and say, because of things that you mentioned and other things, what I say in Chapter 5 of my book is I think the greatest problem facing the United States is the excessive power of the courts and judges making laws rather than just interpreting and applying laws. So, and those are what you pointed out, two definite problems. Okay. Oh, okay, but I'll tell you what, I've got to do these verses on sovereignty because otherwise I'm going to leave you just feeling despair. Listen. Job 12:23. God makes nations great, and he destroys them. He enlarges nations, and he leads them away. Jamie was talking about that this morning. God is sovereign over the course of nations. Psalm 22:28. Kingship belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. Psalm 66:7. God rules by his might forever. His eyes keep watch on the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves. Regarding the destinies of rulers and nations, Psalm 75:6-7, for not from the east or from the west and not from the wilderness comes lifting up, but it is God who executes judgment, putting down one and lifting up another. Psalm 103:19, the Lord has established his throne in the heavens and his kingdom rules over all. Daniel 4:17, the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. Number one, those verses should cause our hearts to have peace and trust in God. And number two, God's sovereignty works in conjunction with our prayers. And part of God's sovereignty is that he answers our prayers. So these verses should stir our hearts to pray for change in the government of China, to pray for change in the government of Venezuela, of North Korea, of Iran. We should pray for change. And if we believe that God rules over the nations, then every time we see these things or hear these things in the news, it should stir us up quickly or perhaps at more length to pray. Ultimately, then, the Lord himself is going to descend from heaven with a cry of command, finally, with the voice of an archangel, with the sound of the trumpet of God, 1 Thessalonians 4:16. That's where history is going. It's not going to be, the world is not going to be ruled by China or Russia or the United Nations or the United States or any other human earthly ruler today. The Lord is coming back. And Revelation 11:15, at that time, the kingdom of this world, it will be true, has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. Our Father, we thank you that you rule over the kingdoms of men and give them to whom you will, that you are indeed sovereign over the nations, and that your purposes for history will stand, and your promises are sure. We thank you that you have good purposes for us and for us in our individual lives. We have your promise that all things work together for good for those who love you and are called according to your purpose. And so we do say to you, Lord, that we love you, that we trust you, and we ask, Lord, for these world situations, that you would give wisdom to our nation and to other nations, that you would let freedom and freedom to obey and serve you and trust in you and hear your gospel spread throughout the nations of the world, even to those nations that do not allow that today. We commit ourselves now into your hands, and we trust you, Lord, for our future. In Jesus' name, amen. See you next week.